Actually, I think in the announcement it's affected theory of unstable top quark, and I just added quark in the brackets to be
So
sure that.
you're really going to tell us about spinning
Yeah,
patterns?
exactly. When I gave a talk at ETH in Zurich, I mean, I didn't put here quark, and this, a few mathematicians came and they were thinking that I would be talking about this real mechanical top. They had fun. So, but anyhow, even this topic, I think it's pretty interesting from at least two perspectives. And first of all, people now start to talk more and more seriously about linear collider in Japan, right? So, and of course, threshold production of TT-bar pairs is one of the most phenomenologically interesting processes to be studied there. And on the other side, I'm going to discuss one of the kind of fundamental questions of quantum field theory, namely how to treat in a systematic way the production of unstable particles, right? So, and here is my sketch of my talk. Again, in the beginning, I will give a very brief introduction. In the theory of TT-bar threshold production, right, and brief review of the result, which we already have here. And then I'll go to the specific subject of the talk, right? So I'm going to describe how one can systematically take into account the finite width effect in TT-bar threshold production beyond the complex energy shift. I will tell you later what is the complex energy shift. And I basically will describe the specific effective theory, which just helped us to do it systematically over the Biot perturbation theory. So I will present the result of application of all this machinery to the calculation of these effects in the next to leading quarter, next to leading quarter. And okay, so. Ita asked me to give a research talk, not a colloquium, so I cannot resist against giving some technical details. But I think, I mean, if I will have time, I will also show how this new effective theory removes spurious divergences which appear in the standard, like old-fashioned description of the TT-bar threshold production in non-relativistic QCD. So, the whole talk is based on a paper written with my former postdoc Jan Pikul recently. Okay, so here is the standard propaganda slide about TT-bar threshold production. Basically, the question is why should one be interested in top threshold production at the linear collider? And the answer is that basically, if you want to learn as much as possible and as accurate as possible about top quark, we should build up a linear collider and go to TT-bar threshold. And again, so from the theory point of view, you know that top quark is really unstable, so it decays in W and B. And the corresponding width is larger, much larger than lambda QCD. So basically, top quark decays before it hadronizes. So one can safely apply perturbative QCD to the description of the a process which involves top quark, right? So no, we have a very accurate theoretical description of the process based on first principle of QCD. From the experimental point of view, the system, of course, is as possible as one can imagine for a strongly interactive particle. And if you combine these two features, you get, again, the most precise determination of the top quark characteristics like mass widths and vector coupling. Right? So with vector coupling, it's more or less obvious. The leading cross-section comes from the vector-dominated production of TT-bar pair. But the specific feature of threshold production is that it's extremely sensitive to the mass and widths. Right? And now I'm going to explain you why it is so. So if you just look, I mean, here, it's a plot of normalized cross-section of the process, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what is this one and so on, right? So because it's normalized, so if you just look at the Born cross section, you see the standard square root of energy, right? I mean, this is the energy counted from the TT bar threshold. So zero corresponds to the double top quark mass, right? So the cross section is a non-relativistic one, so and it grows like square root of energy. This is a standard feature of non-relativistic cross section. So this is a Born cross section. So we switch off top quark width and top quark strong interaction. If you actually switch on strong interaction and switch on the top quark decays, the cross section changes dramatically. Basically, there are two competing effects. One effect is that close to threshold, the Coulomb interaction between TT and T bar results in formation of the quarkonium like resonances, like chermonium or betamonium, it would be toponium, right? On the other hand, top quark is unstable, yeah, it has widths, and the widths of the top quark is comparable to the distances between these, the excited levels of would be toponium, right? So all these resonances are smeared out. And what happens, right, if you just take into account these two competing effects, right, still you have a bump, right, a resonance, and which roughly correspond to would be toponium ground state, right? But anyhow, you see that the cross-section has nothing to do with the Born approximation. And if you look at the resonance cross-section, it's proportional to the strong coupling to the third power, right? And it's obvious it's just a local process, the production is a local process, so it's proportional to wave function at the origin, and the wave function is proportional to alpha is cubed, right? So, and you have gamma t in the denominator, of course, if you have a resonance of zero width, the cross section goes to infinity. So, and the position of the of this bump is roughly speaking alpha s squared times mt. So this is a binding energy of quarkonium bound state, right? So you see there is a strong dependence on gamma t, there is strong dependence on mt, and so if you measure it experimentally with a high precision, you can extract gamma t and mt with a very high precision as well. So this is why it's so special. Of course, you see the strong dependence on alpha s, so one can predict large perturbative corrections, right? At least they should compensate the really strong scale dependence of the leading order result, right? So, and this is indeed the case, and the corrections are large, and it's kind of in focus of the efforts of many groups for a long time. And it's a highly non-trivial problem of perturbative QCD. It's multi-scale, strong coupling, and bound state dynamics, right? So nevertheless, a few groups quite a long time ago, like almost 10 years ago, pushed the analysis up to the second order corrections. And what was found was not very encouraging, because the second order correction turned out to be huge, really huge. And it seems that, I mean, at this point, it seems that the series is divergent, right? So, and if you have divergent series, you cannot make an accurate theoretical prediction. So there was some.
Can you say the second order in what?
In alpha. And alpha is.
Yeah. Of the vertex,
yes.
Gamma z.
Well, there are many of them, right? Because you have to take into account the correction to the binding energy and all of the things. So. It's, yeah, it's, you develop perturbation theory bound the Coulomb approximation, not about the free approximation, to take into account its threshold effects, right? So it's not that easy, but in principle, yes, it's correction, second order corrections in outputs. So, and people try to associate these huge corrections to different contributions, specific contributions, for example, to renormalon contribution, which is factorially growing with number of like order, right, which you have. People also try to associate it with the threshold logs, because of the binding effect, you have corrections which are non-analytic in alpha s, which include logarithms. So formally, this is a large number. So people try to associate huge corrections with this logarithm. But it turns out that neither this nor this actually dominates the correction, right? So it became clear that one has to go for the full pseudo analysis, and then to just it would become clear whether we can do something or we can do nothing, right? So and here, I mean, and actually this mission is almost completed. I mean, for the energy level, so basically for the position of this bump, the pseudo correction is all already available. And here you see, I mean, basically this is a pseudo correction to the resonance position, normalized to the leading order binding energy. So you have alpha s cube, and here you see, I mean, the correction is really huge because there is no pi to the cube in the denominator. So you have huge numbers, right? And you see this is a Renormalan contribution. This is a logarithmic contribution. And this is a generic contribution. So you have three contributions approximately of the same size. So you have to go like, you have to know all the numbers to have a reliable prediction, right? So, and here you can see the, I mean, here you can see that the pseudo correction is really very important. This is the next to leading order result. So basically binding energy is a function of normalization scale. So this is a leading order, next to leading order. So leading order doesn't fit in this book, right? So next to leading order, the huge second order correction. So the second order result is unstable, right? And then you, if you add n cube leading order, you have a smooth, weak mu dependence, and you have a kind of minimum or zero dependence on mu at approximately 15 GV, and this is exactly the physical scale of the problem. So it's inverse Bohr radius of the Quarconium bound state, toponium bound state. So everything works as expected, right? So and actually, this is for the resonance position and for the resonance strength for the cross section of the resonance. The state of the correction is all already known, right? They are not published yet, so because we are in the process of cross checking the results. Right, and so basically, if you consider the dependence of the result on the strong coupling, we are more or less on the safe side. We have a control over the perturbation theory now. So, but you remember that the result for the cross section depends not only on alpha s, it also depends on gamma, right? Strongly depends on gamma. So, if we already have a nice description of the strong interaction effects, now we have to care about the dependence of, like, whether we take into account the instability of top quark in a proper way, and what is accuracy of the approximation which we use. And here comes an interesting point. And basically, for a long time, the instability of top quark was taken into account through this imaginary shift of the energy, right? Why it is so? I mean, basically, this is a quantum mechanical wisdom, right? So unstable particle correspond to the pole of the propagator, not at the real value of energy, but at the pole of the propagator is shifted to the complex, to the unphysical sheet of the complex energy plane, right? So, and this is literally the prescription which was used by Feynman. It was a long time ago. So you take the cross section and you perform this shift and you get the result, right? So, but already, okay, these guys were are really smart, and already a long time ago, they knew that this prescription is not consistent beyond the leading order. But people were too busy with calculating the strong coupling corrections. And only recently, again, after we got control over the perturbative QCD, right? So the people start to think about the proper implementation of the top quark finite widths. And actually, the real breakthrough came like sufficiently recently, right? So, and it's based on actually using the affected theory of unstable particles, right? And Martin Beneke and co-authors, they used like a QCD-inspired effective theory of unstable particles. So they managed to push the analysis to the next leading order. And I'm going to talk about this, okay, the crowning achievement in this analysis, right? So it's also effective theory of unstable particles, but it's based on non-relativistic effective theory, right? Yeah, we managed to push the analysis to next to leading order, which is completely sufficient, right, for our purpose, for any phenomenological goal. Okay, so now it was a very lengthy introduction, sorry. So now I'm going to introduce a problem, right, and introduce a solution. So the problem is, okay, so before going to unstable quark, let me consider this tabletop, right? So like just to make all the further step clear, right? So to compute the cross-section, one normally uses the optical theorem. So basically, the optical theorem tells that the cross-section is related to the imaginary part of the forward scattering amplitude. So this is a forward scattering amplitude, obviously, right? So you have one loop. You have to compute the imaginary part of this loop to get total cross-section. Yeah, everybody knows this. So and if you do this, I mean, you have just the normal integral over four momentum. So you pick up the pole of one of the propagators and take the integral over zero component of the momentum by residues, so it kills one of the propagator, and this is what you are left with, up to some inessential vector, right? So if you look here, you see that it's just p squared minus mte, so e is the energy of top pair, p is the three momentum, so this is the inverse Schrödinger equation, right? Basically, this is what one expects, right? So the propagation of non-relativistic top is described by the Schrödinger equation. So it's the propagator is inverse equation of motion. So you should have the Schrödinger equation in denominators, right? So this integral seems to be divergent, right? But if you take the imaginary part, you get the finite result. So the divergence is sitting in the real part of the integral, right? So the evaluation is actually rather straightforward, and you get this square root of e, right? For positive e, it scales like square root. This is what we saw on one of the previous slides. Of course, I mean, again, this the imaginary part of this integral can be easily computed if one remembers that the imaginary part of the propagator is just a delta function. Again, this delta function, if you look at the argument, it simply sets top quark on mass shell. So its three momentum is equal to the energy, right? So this integral is a kind of fictitious. So what happens now if you consider unstable top? Okay. If top is unstable, right? Basically, what you see in the final state is not the top quark, is a WB pair. So you have to take into account the process which is described by this diagram, and you have to like, just take this cut. I think everybody understands that this is just a contribution to the top quark mass iterator, right? So basically, it renormalizes the mass of top quark, its wave function, the real part of this guy. But you also have an imaginary part of this guy, right? And imaginary part of this guy, and it's written here, right? So let me explain some notations. In principle, this mass operator is a very complicated function, right? Not very complicated, but okay. Not simple function of W mass, top mass, and basically the incoming momentum. So I do not want to write it down here. I just would like to take advantage of the fact that top quark is non-relativistic, right? So, and it's almost on shell. You remember it. If you consider a stable top, you have on shell top in the final state. Of course, if you consider unstable top, it should be close to mass shell, right? So I introduced two variables. One variable measures the off shellness of the top quark. And another variable measures the difference between W and MT. Right? If we consider top quark and W boson to be very heavy and approximately of the same size, the W boson will also be non-relativistic, right? So we will see actually in more rigorous ways that small rho correspond to non-relativistic approximation for W as well. Okay, so if we consider that as a small parameter and rho as a small parameter, we can take this complex, complicated function and expand it in these variables. And this is what we get. And I would like to, I mean, discuss it a little bit because, again, all the further analysis will be clear if you understand the simple formula, right? So On shell top core corresponds to Z equal to zero, right? P squared is equal to ME. Standard relation, right? So for Z equal to zero, this theta function is obviously zero because rho is positive. Everything is zero. So actually all the terms here vanishes. And this tells us that the imaginary part of the mass iterator is simply equal to the top quark width over two, as one expects, right? So the imaginary part of the mass iterator is the width of the particle. Another interesting fact is that if Z is sufficiently large, if Z is larger than rho, this theta function disappears. And actually, this theta function is equal to one, right? So, and this gamma over two cancels this gamma over two, and you have zero. And this basically means that if top quark is far off shell, it cannot produce, just kinematically, it cannot produce real W and B pair, right? So, okay, so for large Z, for far off shell top quark, the imaginary part vanishes. So the top quark here should be close to mass shell. And again, oops. You remember, as I mentioned, when Z is equal to zero, so when top quark is on shell, we have only this contribution. So we have, we are sitting on the top quark resonance. So it's a standard notation if you want, or standard words, right? Standard description of this contribution. So it corresponds to the resonant top quark, so it's a resonant contribution. So.
In the original slide.
Yep. Which one? This one.
This is the same as the factor polarization.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So you have to worry about occasion variance of regularization.
This, I will definitely mention the gauge invariance, right? So yeah, this is gauge invariant. If you look at this diagram, this is not gauge invariant.
No.
Yeah. But this, just, yeah, I will definitely come to this point. This is actually what I wanted to say right at the moment, right? So this guy is gauge invariant because the width of the on-shell particle is gauge invariant observable F. This is not gauge invariant, so using different gauge, you will get a different contribution here. And this is one of the problems which we are going to solve, because people substitute this guy into the denominator, perform the Dyson resummation of this contribution, get long gauge invariant result, and use it in particle data group. So we, I mean, this is not a joke, right? And I'm actually, I mean, one of the aim of the work was to sort all these problems out. Right?
Usually, parent state calculations, parent state decays,
mm-hmm.
not gauge invariant. It's very hard to make them gauge invariant because it's a parent state.
Yeah. Again, we will get a result for the cross section, which is absolutely gauge invariant, and this is basically the prescription how to do the calculation with unstable particles. Right? So. Okay, and the rest is, of, since this is a resonant contribution, which is gauge invariant, this is a part of the non-resonance contribution, which is not gauge invariant. So let's consider the gauge invariant object first. So what we are going to do, we are going to, I mean, as like the standard prescription, when you have some mass shift, right? So you, through the Dyson resummation, you put this, the correction to the mass to the denominator. You can do exactly the same thing with this resonant contribution. The only difference is that you have imaginary contribution, right? So not real, so you resum it, and you have, instead of this propagator, you have this kind of propagator. And again, this is gauge invariant, right? And this is, if you look at this, this is exactly the prescription by Fadian and Hose. So you have a complex energy shift in your propagator. So, and, it's actually a natural thing. So instead of delta function now, you have a Braid-Wigner curve. So instead of delta function resonance, you have a kind of Braid-Wigner resonance, which you actually see in the experiment. And of course, if you compute the integral over dp with this function, you get exactly this result, because it's just a complex shift of the energy. And but now there is only one difference. Now the integral over p is not fictitious. You have a distribution, right? You have this Bredt-Wigner distribution. If you look at the kinematics, right? I mean, again, it's a simple algebra. So this p squared measures the difference between top quark mass and the invariant mass of the product, right? So I mean, this is approximate sign because I put e equal to zero. So I'm considering on threshold top quark production, right? So the integral over p is the integral over invariant mass distribution of the decay products. Okay. Okay. So now we have a little bit different situation. Again, resonant contribution correspond to on-shell top, right? This non-resonant contribution correspond to on-shell W and B. Again, we have some kinematical constraint because the invariant mass of WB pair cannot be smaller than the mass of W, obviously. And just by kinematics, it cannot be larger than top quark mass, right? Because you are sitting on the threshold. So you have basically from this relation, you have a restriction on the integral, right? On the integral over p squared. And again, here I put e equal to zero. So on-shell top corresponds to p squared equal to zero. And this corresponds to off-shell top quark. So off-resonant contribution. So basically, this non-resonant contribution comes from the region outside the resonance, and from the fact that this difference is not equal to zero outside the resonance. So this is why it's called non-resonant. And in principle, you can take, I mean, again, you can take this contribution, plug it into the integral which we had before, and get some contribution to the cross section. It will be not gauge invariant for the moment. Again, just you will see how it can be cured, right? Or it's only part of the result. But in principle, this is what one should do. It will give you contribution to the cross section of TWB. Of course, you cannot distinguish between resonant and non-resonant production because in any case, what you have TWB in the final state. Right, so you cannot distinguish between them. So you have to take everything into account. So, but if you just try to use this as a perturbation and plug it into the integral and compute the integral, I mean, you will have a mess, right? Because you have a very complicated, in principle, the sigma, is, as I mentioned, is a very complicated function of the parameters. So you need perform a really tough calculation at tools. So, and here we have a kind of starting point for the application of the non-relativistic theory. Before computing anything, one should think first, right? So, and if one look at this kinematical constraint, one immediately notice that if rho, you remember, rho is a parameter which basically measures the difference between top and W mass. So, if we consider W as massive as top, rho is small. And if you look at this relation, so if rho is small, so it's a condition for the non-relativistic top quark, obviously, right? So the three-dimensional momentum is much less smaller than the mass. So if we consider rho as a small parameter, our theory becomes non-relativistic. And of course, I mean, W and T are considered to be of the same mass, right? So if T is non-relativistic, W is also non-relativistic. B is considered to be massless, so it's ultra-relativistic. And we can actually perform the expansion in this parameter rho exactly in the same way as the expansion is performed in non-relativistic QCD. I mean, here you can see P. I mean, this you can just forget about it. I mean, the standard non-relativistic QCD suggested by Lipash and Castle a long time ago, right? So you can perform this expansion using the same technique as you use in the standard non-relativistic QCD, right? But one should see the difference, right? In non-relativistic QCD, p squared is equal to e squared, right? So it's on shell by condition, p squared is equal to e, sorry, divided by m. So the condition of non-relativistic, of applicability of non-relativistic theory is that e divided by m, which is v squared, which is small, right? So in non-relativistic QCD, v, or top quark velocity, is an expansion parameter. Here, if you just compare it to the expressions, right, you see that instead of v, you have square root of rho, right? So it's basically the same non-relativistic condition as non-relativistic QCD, but now the small parameter is not the top quark velocity, it's just this rho, which measures the difference between top and WMS. But nevertheless, you can perform the calculation with the non-relativistic Feynman rules, for example, right? So, okay, in practice, rho is about 1/2, right? So now the question is whether 1/2 is a large number or it is a small number. And at the end of the talk, I will prove you that 1/2 is a small number.
Yeah, 4 pi is working away.
Hmm?
Is it because 4 pi is working away?
No, because the convergence of the expansion, the convergence radius is actually pretty large, right? So it's not, the expansion is of course in rho, but the coefficients are like, I mean,
I think it essentially there is 4 pi greater than LP.
Yes, yeah, in a sense, yes. It's not 4 pi exactly, right? But yeah, it's different coefficients which help you to get a convergence, right? So it's, yeah, when you see this, I mean, of course you doubt that you can expand in it, but you can. Again, you will see.
Well, I mean, you really should be talking about the square root of that, right?
Yes, it's even worse, yeah, which is even worse, right? Nevertheless, it's, yeah, so you catch me, I mean, I'm cheating, right? Yeah, that's it, actually the expansion parameter is square root of this, and it's even worse, but it converges. So again, so I'm going to introduce the effective theory. So basically, if you are going to introduce an effective theory, so you should identify the scales and the corresponding modes, right? So I suppose that everybody knows what is a non-relativistic QCD, so I do not go into details. So in non-relativistic QCD, you have hard scale, which is top, like heavy quark mass. You have soft scale, which is basically the momentum, right? You can think that this is the inverse Bohr radius for the quarkonium. So characteristic three momentum of the quark in quarkonium. And you have ultra soft scale, which is basically the binding energy, like V squared. For a non-relativistic quark, square of the three momentum is equal to the energy, right, on shell condition. So you have the scales, you have corresponding modes, you can take QCD Lagrangian, expand it in V, get Feynman rules, and use these Feynman rules for the calculation. These Feynman rules are much simpler than the one of QCD. So now we have an alternative theory, which has exactly the same characteristic scales, right? So the only exception is instead of V, you have square root of rho. So you can do exactly the same. The only difference is that now you have, of course, W boson, you have big quarks, so you have new particles, but nevertheless, you can take the full electroweak Lagrangian, perform the expansion, get some simplified Feynman rules, and use these Feynman rules for the calculation, right? So, of course, if you, you remember that actually we have both scales in the problem, right? Because we are off threshold and we have unstable top. So both these scales and these scales are present in the theory. And if you try to perform the calculation, like with all the scales in the problem, I mean, you fail. It's a complete mess. So the next step, just to simplify your life, is to separate the scales. So to impose the scale here. This is a standard trick for the effective theory. And okay, here you see the standard scaling rules for non-relativistic QCD. So alpha s is of order v, just because you know you have to take into account the Coulomb effects, and Coulomb effects are basically suppressed by, they're not suppressed, they're proportional by to the powers of alpha divided by v. So alpha and v are of the same order. So you are very close to threshold. So they're much smaller than one. And remember that when we consider the Born cross-section, we had gamma staying like along with, entering along with E, right? So gamma should be of order of E. E is of order of V squared. So gamma should be of order of V squared. And gamma is proportional to electroweak coupling constants. So basically, square root of electroweak constant should scale like. So this is a standard scaling rules for non-relativistic QCD treatment. But we supplement this scaling rules with this scaling rules, right? So we consider rho to be much larger than V, but to be much smaller than 1. And normally the characteristic velocity of top quark near threshold is 1/10. So this is satisfied always. This, as I mentioned, is not so nice approximation, but again, I'm going to prove that 1/2 and even 7/10, which is is a small number, right? So, and if we do, if we impose this hierarchy, we immediately get a simplification because we can completely forget about V. We can just put our system on threshold, right? We will never have any problem, right? With entanglement of these two scales. And also, it's non-relativistic expansion, so we expect that we will have this Coulomb effect, right? So remember that Coulomb effect in normal non-relativistic QCD is alpha s divided by V. Here we will have something alpha s divided by square root of 1/2, square root of rho, sorry. And since we have this scaling, so we can just forget about them. We have to sum up this Coulomb effects here, but we can just truncate the series in this case. So, okay, this is a technical thing. So, maybe it may look confusing, especially for those who are not in the business, right? So let me show how all this machinery works if I consider like the next leading non-resonant contribution, just real contribution to the cross-section. So resonant contribution, we have already learned what it is. So it's proportional to V. So the non-resonant contribution, you remember that we take the non-resonant contribution in perturbation theory. We do not perform the Dyson resummation, right? So it's proportional to gamma, at least to the first power. And you remember our scaling rules, gamma is proportional to V squared. So the non-resonant contribution enters the next two leading order, according to this power counting. And this is actually, again, this was appreciated already by Fadden and Hosel a long time ago, but people didn't pay attention. So what one has to do? One has to take this guy. I mean, this we already took into account to get this gamma. And you see, the dependence on gamma is non-analytic. It's because of Dyson resummation. So for the difference, we don't have to perform this Dyson resummation. We take it as a perturbation. And again, it's, of course, gauge dependent, right? And why it is gauge dependent? Because basically, we consider, again, the process when we have one top quark, W and B, right, in the final state. So we basically, to get a full and result, which is gauge invariant, one has to add all the two loop diagrams with such a cut. And at this point, of course, the gauge invariance is restored. So you write down this, all the two loop diagrams with this cut, include this guy. Basically expanding E, remember that E is small parameter and is E proportional to V squared, so we can forget about this. Then we perform the expansion in rho. At this point, we recover the non-relativistic propagator and vertices in our effective theory. And one can actually easily see that the dominant contribution comes from the momentum, virtual momentum region when T and W are potential, as I mentioned, so they the energy scales like square of the three momentum, and B is ultra soft, right? So it's fully relativistic. So, and this is the diagrams. I mean, they look messy, right? There are many of them, but again, if you look at the leading order contribution in rho, you identify only two diagrams which contribute, this one and this one. And you can actually compute them by hand. Because, I mean, this is the most terrifying diagram, right? Many parameters, top mass, W mass, box diagram, like tulip diagram. It's not a piece of cake. If you perform the expansion, these guys, the neutrinos, they're off-shell, so they're off-shell, so they shrink to the point, all these propagators shrink to the point, and you have the same topology as this diagram, and you, again, I computed it by hand in a couple of hours. Right, so, and this is a very simple result. So, this is a contribution of photon, of Z boson, and W, right? So this is a contribution to the cross-section. So we should add it to what we had before after this complex energy shift, right? Okay. Oops. And now, yep.
If you recall the Gaussian gradients.
Yep. Yes, it's just a simple answer to your question. Of course, we computed this in the general gauge, and we observed the gauge parameter cancellation. And now, actually, if you look at these diagrams, you can immediately identify that you really need this diagram, because here you have Z and two Zs and W. And to have a gauge invariance, you should have three W's in the diagram. And this is exactly the diagram with three W's. Yeah. So this is the result. And the only thing we should worry about is that, again, whether 1/2 is a small number or it's a large number. Unfortunately, if you have a nice postdoc, he can compute like as many terms of the expansion as you want. And this is what we did. And this is just for one diagram, this is the convergence of raw expansion, right? It's not very impressive, but yeah. So it's like the Lie encoder and so on. But this is for a single diagram. If you go.
Probably if you chose before was the top dotted line, isn't it?
Sorry? This is the real value of rho.
No, the formula you showed us before, that was NLO, so that...
Yeah. NLO... this is... This is the expansion in rho. So this is the leading order of expansion.
Right, in this...
In the plot...
Where is that in the plot?
This is the second line, but this is for one diagram. Just wait for the moment. So this is the convergence, and this is actually what we should recover. This vertical line is the physical value of rho. So, it's not bad, but it's not good, right?
But how do you know what you're comparing to? I guess I don't know what are the other ones. So the second line is an order is smaller than the one that you showed us by a power of root rho.
In principle, you can push the button and get like 10 terms of the expansion easily. So this is,
I'm trying to understand what that means. So I take the graphs that you showed.
This is powers of rho. So this is the leading order, which was shown on the previous slide.
Yeah.
This is including the term, which has an additional rho suppression. So it's rho to the power one.
So the same two graphs, but I expand.
Yes, yeah, exactly. No, including all the other graphs. Yeah, because they start to contribute, not at the same order, but yeah, of course you have to take all of them. Right, it was only for the leading contribution that these two graphs contribute.
Okay.
Right, yeah. So, and then you take, I think some of the graphs start to contribute in higher orders, right?
And the solid line is you just numerically evaluate all the graphs?
This one.
The solid one, yeah. The black line that is not dashed. The curved black line that's not dashed.
This one. This is, we see that, it, yeah, in a sense, yeah, we have a numerical result, actually, for non-expanded diagrams as well. Yeah, but you see the convergence anyhow. And this was for a single diagram. If you consider the sum of the diagram, you see an interesting situation. This is the leading result, and this is the exact result.
So what's the distinction between this and the previous one?
Because this was just one diagram.
So in diagrams you're talking about are all this one where you had the bubble.
Yeah.
And the,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it wasn't all. So in those successive dotted ones, you weren't looking at all the graphs there. You were looking
yes.
at the specific graph.
Yeah. For this particular, right? Yeah. But we can do the same for all the. If you go to higher orders, you have to take into account all of them to get this curve, right? this black curve takes into account everything, all the diagrams, all the terms. This gives the leading order term, which is given only by two diagrams, right? So, and this took me 2 hours to compute, and this took like about 1 year to compute.
So not, cancellation.
Yes, somehow there is a cancellation. I do not know the reason, but probably, I mean, the reason is that the gauge invariant quantities.
Yeah, right.
Yes, yeah.
So how do you actually compute the exact result?
I mean, you can either take like 10 terms of the expansion, right, and you see that it converges, right? Or you can like compute all the integrals numerically. We did it as a cross-check, right? But unfortunately, you cannot do the same in the next order. In the next order, you have to rely on the expansion and row. And yeah, this is exactly the point.
You need more
postdocs. No, actually, this I did myself because, yeah. So if you go one order higher, if you just would like to look how the QCD corrections affect the result, because it, remember, if you consider simply the cross-section, the QCD doesn't work well. You have really large contribution in high orders. So we have to control this. And you have to dress all the diagrams with gluons, right? But again, if you are looking for the leading term, there are only two diagrams to dress, which is a dramatic simplification. So you have these diagrams, which looks nasty, right? Especially this one. But again, I mean, I did it by hand, like in 2 days. Why? Because you have, I mean, you can use in the lead to get the leading order result. You can use a non-relativistic approximation. So this is non-relativistic. This is non-relativistic. So these guys shrink to the point. So you have basically the same topology as here, right? Here you have you basically this is a standard. Effective theory calculation game. So you identify the virtual momentum region where the dominant contribution comes from. You made a simplification of the Feynman rules and you easily perform the integration. And I think I have to go. Okay, yeah. So basically, just I think I still have some moment, right? So some time. So basically, you perform this. You take into account that this guy is non-relativistic, it's very close to its mass shell. So you perform the expansion of this mass operator, right? So it's not a function anymore, it's just a simple series, right? You can truncate it, right? So you see only logarithmic dependence on rho exists, right? So it's not, it's not a problem. Right. So, and there is no, logarithmic dependence on Z. Right, Z is basically related to this virtual momentum. So you plug it in, you perform the expansion, this shrinks to the point, you perform the integral, and you get the result. Right, actually this logarithm of rho is fictitious because if you factor out the top quark widths, so this logarithm is absorbed by this top quark widths. Right, so by the correction to the top quark widths. So, and surprisingly again, you can get a closed analytical expression. You can imagine. I mean, if you try to do it in the exact way, I mean, you have a whole bunch of diagrams, three loop diagrams, very complicated topology. I mean, you can not even hope that you can get something like this, right? So if you perform expansion, not only you can do everything by hand, but you have the result, which is like very nice and close, and it involves the second order polylogarithm. And
so at this point, can we see what it is that makes the expansion small? What is it that goes with rho that makes it small?
You see, I do not see any particular reason why the expansion works well. It just comes out.
Which is a numerical accident.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So. But I mean, you saw on the previous slide that what is the exact curve and what is the approximation, right? They're very close. I don't know why.
There's only one parallel alpha.
Sorry?
It only comes in proportion to alpha sub s.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
The alpha sub s could be first of all.
Yes.
Alpha s.
Yeah, because originally it was completely electroweak diagram. So we add one gluon, So it's next to leading in alpha S, but it's, you remember that in comparison to the leading order cross section, the leading cross section scales like square root of gamma.
So and we have small.
Yeah. So it's like yeah, it's parametrically it's not large, I would say. Yeah. So it's consistent. It's just next to leading order result. So, and you can actually see, it's funny. You can see here the power of small parameter in denominator. So, and of course, this is a trace of the Coulomb singularity. Like in the standard non-relativistic QCD, you have alpha s over v, and here we have alpha s over square root of rho. And but you remember that we have a scaling rule where this guy is much larger than this one, that we can just keep only this term and do not resum it all, like we do in non-relativistic QCD. So, and
actually, since you mentioned it, you've already got the alpha s of the square root of rho in front.
Yeah, this one, but this is artificial because if you look at this gamma, it's already proportional to rho to some high power. Because, of course, if top quark is of the same mass as W, it does not decay. So if rho is equal to zero, so gamma is equal to zero, this, I think just from the phase space, it should be like third power or something like this. Yeah. So it's just...
One over side to the fourth. Quite large.
Yeah, but again, I mean, yeah. The, yeah, but again, if you just look, I mean, if you look at the leading order result, it's already here. It's already here. So it's just a factor which it's a kind of artificial, right? Because gamma is proportional to rho to some, I mean, because I put it in this way. So there is no further enhancement in comparison to the next leading order result. Yeah, so, and what you see also is a new power of, I mean, basically you have a new parameter in the theory, new scale in the theory, which is rho times m. So in effective theory, when you have a new scale, normally you have a logarithm of scale ratio, right? And you have a logarithm of scale ratio here. And you can consider it as a large logarithm. You can develop a corresponding renormalization group in the effective theory, sum up all this logarithm, but it's of course, I mean, you will see the size of the correction, so it's not that important, right? So this I'll skip. It's too technical, right? And here you see the effect, right? So this is basically the complex energy shift, right? So the Fadden-Jose approximation. Then you have a next to leading order correction, which is about 7%, which is very large for this precise measurements, if you want, right? And then the next leading correction is even smaller, so it's like 2% or so. So you have a fast convergence series, so you shouldn't worry about it. And okay, I think it's time for the summary. Okay, so what I presented is a systematic way to take into account the instability of top quark in the production of the Bohr pairs threshold, you can use exactly the same approach, exactly the same methodology, for example, to consider, to describe the Higgs, unstable Higgs production, right? So it's exactly the same. And it's actually, I mean, if you have supersymmetric Higgs, which is heavy and which decays fast, I mean, you have to implement something like this, right? And this is what they now implement in the wrong way by putting the mass operator, like momentum dependent widths in the propagator of the Higgs, which is again not only gauge dependent, but it's completely inconsistent, as you can see.
I have a silly question.
Yeah.
The peg table over here tells you 173 over beta.
Yeah. Okay, it should be M, of course, it should be MW over MT, sorry. Yeah. No. It's just a misprint, but you are the first person who knows this. Yeah.
Yeah,
I have it right on previously, right? Yeah. So basically, I mean, the message is not only that, I mean, we have now, I think it was puzzling me from the time when I was student how to treat unstable particles. Now I can tell you that I more or less understand how to do this. Right? And.
You didn't have the same tablet.
Huh? So, and this is my personal view, but the whole construction is pretty clear and aesthetically appealing. I mean, if you compare it, I mean, again, you have three loop diagrams, box diagrams. This is machinery, you can do it by hand. Okay, that's it. I mean, actually, you know Babis Anastasio. He approached me when it was not clear whether what they saw was the Higgs, right? I mean, people were speculating about heavy Higgs, right? And why they didn't see the heavy Higgs. And one of the possible explanations was that if you just change the treatment of the cross-section, you can actually hide these heavy Higgs from Tevatron or something like this. So I mean, he planned to do this for this case. When you have heavy Higgs, but due to this finite width effect, the cross-section goes down. Actually, you see here that it goes down. And then they just do not see it because they didn't take into account this contribution. But all of a sudden, they discovered the Higgs. So it was not actual anymore, right? But if you consider heavy Higgs, heavy supersymmetric Higgs, of course, you can do this, right? I mean, you should do this. Yeah.
But you're saying that the Tevatron people, when they analyzed the data, were doing it in a gauge-dependent way?
They even now they do it in a gauge-dependent way.
Maybe it's a gauge where you shouldn't discover it yet.
No, but, I mean, the analysis itself doesn't depend on how you operate the cross-section, right? They're just looking for resonance.
No,
the question is, what is the bound you put on the cross?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And the bound really
is only relevant for the heavy Higgs where the width becomes.
Yeah, yeah, because real Higgs is too narrow. Yeah, that's true. Real Higgs is too narrow. Yeah. So you have these effects, but they're small. So I don't know. I mean, if I do not like supersymmetry. Sorry.
But I was hoping they could measure which gauge is right.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Any more questions? Also, if not, let's thank the speaker again.